Hello and welcome to this episode of Views from Down Under. I'm Alex Tan, your host, and today the team is slightly smaller, but probably still a lot chattier than usual as well. The usual team. I have Orson here with me in the office as we record this, and Neil is joining us online with a very nice poster in the back of the Views from Down Under logo. Today, we wanted to talk about this big news that is happening right now. It's all over the news today that Iran has launched missile and drone attacks on Israel proper in retaliation for Israel's attack on its consulate that killed a major Iranian military leader in Damascus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this attack has been expected, but now it actually has happened, and it's still going on. It's live as of today. And the other topic that we want to talk about is this idea of the United States becoming imposing industrial policy, and its trade policy under Biden has pretty much doubled down on what Donald Trump started.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And we want to piggyback this on Yellen's most recent visit to China, wherein the U.S. Treasury Secretary criticized Chinese approach to its current solution for its current economic problems.
Yep.
So without further ado, let's get in to this Iranian attack on Israel. And Orson, would you give us the lowdown on this thing? And, you know, why did it happen? What's happening right now? What are the risks for our region?
So on April 1st, the Israelis actually missiled the Iranian consulate in Damascus in Syria, and at that point, they claimed the life of one of the high-ranking commanders in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and seven other high-ranking leaders of the IRG. So we knew it was incoming. The Iranians have, since the 1st of April, have been promising that there will be a retaliation of some sort. They consider it an act of war. The Syrian government denounced it as an act of terrorism. And in the past 2 days, there was a lot of chatter online that Iran was actually gearing up to actively attack Israel. So the U.S. Scrambled its fleet to the Arabian Gulf to prepare for that. The U.K. was scrambling its jets and all that. And lo and behold, this morning, New Zealand time, we heard the news that, you know, the Israelis launched a whole salvo, which started with, like, drones and then ballistic missiles and cruise missiles, and then Hezbollah timed the attack together, shooting rockets over, and the Houthis as well timed the attack. And in Israel itself, you had the activation of the Iron Dome. You know, police were going around warning everybody to get out of their houses, go to the nearest bomb shelter, everything. But till to the latest news that we can see is there's no actual casualties. Jordan has claimed to shoot down a couple of missiles that entered Jordanian airspace. When Iran announced that they were sending the drones, Jordan closed its airspace and warned Iran that if they tried to attack Israel via Jordanian airspace, they would retaliate. The US and UK scrambled their fighters and they were able to shoot down some missiles. And in general, I guess you would say the defense system in Israel worked. The Iron Dome worked. You know, its first true litmus test. You know, it's never faced a salvo like this before, and it worked. But the question for us now is, where does that leave the state of Iran-Israel relationship? Because you get a sense, especially from the statements that the Iranians release via their delegation at the United Nations, you know, that they don't really want to poke the hornet's nest, in a sense. They don't want to escalate any tension. But at the same time, you know, we expected this because the Iranians had to respond. Israeli bombing of their embassy is an act of war to them. And, you know, the Iranian public will not be able to take it sitting down.
Well, raiding like the Ecuadorians on the Mexican embassy, that is an international no-no, you know? And so so you've never seen that. By the way, let me acknowledge Nick logging in with us today. We're just starting to talk about, you know, today's news about the Iran attack on Israel proper. And for us, you know, again, this region is very far from us over here in the Asia Pacific, but there are repercussions because the Strait of Hormuz, where a lot of trade is done, you know, the Iranians just boarded an Israeli ship, you know, the Houthis might be doing something more on the Red Sea and the Straits over there as well. So again, there are implications in a very, very fragile economic situation that we have right now. These are not welcome news, and I noticed that oil prices spiked again, so as usual. So besides the economics-wise, though, I mean, do you see, you know, any danger of this whole thing spilling and just spreading the war?
Yes. I think before we continue, we need to unpack what's going on in Iran in the first place. Just last week, I read up about the state of values in Iran, and the fact that, you know, religion and Islam is no longer a big thing in Iran, which is quite something. Because you think about the Iranian Republic, and the fact that the Ayatollah has for so many years had a stranglehold on power via their hold over the religion over there. Apparently, you know, increasingly the Iranian citizens are no longer driven by their religious values or beliefs in Islam, but more a nationalistic belief that Iran is a budding power in the region. And we know that Iran is a budding power in the region because it has slowly reached out. It has all its proxies, whether it is Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, you know, it is in a direct competition with Saudi Arabia on that schism in Islam, and trying to project its influence as well. It has a ballistics missile program and apparently a nuclear program that, you know, no one can really confirm whether they have it or not, but they're there. And if the Ayatollah's grip on power is no longer assured based on religion, then he's going to have to step up this idea that
nationalism becomes the replacement for that.
And we know how dangerous nationalism is.
Oh, it's very non-rational. You know, I mean, it doesn't. And by the way, nationalism, let us remind our listeners here that nationalism is not the patent or copyright of authoritarian regimes only.
Yes.
You know, nationalism can be played by anyone
and everyone,
even liberal democracies. Mm-hmm. You know, so that is just a reminder that politics plays like that. And interestingly, you mentioned the fact that religiosity amongst Iranian public is on the decline, but nationalism is on the up.
Yep.
And Iranians reaching out to their allies in this region actually started playing out with this Shiite and Sunni schism, yep. Right? So all of these fringe groups that are supportive of Iran in the different countries in the Middle East, most of them are Shiites, and even in Iraq, right? I mean, there's a large contingent of Shiites there, and the tension between the Shiites and Sunnis are actually very real. Do you see any? Guys, do you see any flow-on effect for us here in our region, particularly when you think of, you know, when you think of India, the large population there, when you think of large Muslim population in India, what about in Malaysia and Indonesia? Do you see any danger of this getting out of hand? I'm just worried. I'm just really worried that this is just pouring more petrol on an incendiary situation already.
The problem is it's Iran and it's Shiite. I know it in the largest Shiite group outside of the Middle East is in India at the moment, I think. But in Southeast Asia, it's the Sunnis that, you know, and it's Sunni Islam that holds sway. Like the rising conservatism and Islamization of Southeast Asia is driven a lot because Saudi Arabia poured a lot of money to send a lot of its preachers in the early 2000s to spread its version of Islam in Southeast Asia. So there is that little kind of divide at the moment. Like, yes, Malaysia supports Hamas, but that's a Palestinian, it's more couched in a Palestinian issue, but Iran is a different proponent altogether.
Mm. How's the world reacting to this? How's India reacting?
Well, I think so far, the conundrum for India as far as Israel and Iran on this whole issue is concerned is in that classical Indian way, you've got strong relations on both sides. When the conflict first broke out between Palestine and Israel, India was sort of dancing this delicate dance of supporting Israel, but then also trying to reaffirm its historic position of having and advocating for the Palestinian cause, which it has done on and off over the years. With Iran, it's a similar situation. India, as far as the Middle East is concerned, depends on oil from most countries in the Middle East. India has carried on buying oil from Iran for quite some time. It's the same with other parts of the Middle East. And that dependency and the fact that it also has a large domestic Muslim population makes it very precarious for India to respond in any credible way. So I think so far what we've heard is a call for de-escalation, on both sides, for caution on both sides, for diplomacy to prevail on both sides. But I think there is a certain level of trepidation in India, not just for the domestic ramifications which might come out of this, but also the fact that any further disruption is going to make India's reliance on energy, particularly from the Middle East, even more acute at this point in time.
There's also the situation, Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a large Indian migrant worker populations in many parts of the country, right?
Absolutely. So and we've seen the consequences of conflict in the Middle East on
labor
that aspect of the Indian economy. And what I'm referring to in this instance is the early 1990s and the first Gulf War, where India had a lot of workers stationed in Kuwait. They had to be airlifted overnight, but the fall in remittances as a result precipitated a serious economic crisis in India, which is considered to be the catalyst for those liberalization reforms that we saw in the 1990s. So from an economic perspective as well, this is hauntingly similar to what India witnessed in the 1990s, because the extent of the reliance of remittances that India's had on its workers stationed in the Middle East, particularly in these oil-rich countries.
Yeah, Nick, what do you see the Americans' next move on this?
Well,
calling restraint on Israel not to hit back.
Well, I mean, their goal has to be somehow to reach a more stable situation. Going to struggle, but they have to aim for that by whatever means possible. I would point out a few things. As you mentioned, this does highlight a general structural increase in instability in world politics.
Yes.
Which this is an example of. Mm-hmm. And also, in respect to the region we're interested in, the Indo-Pacific, the interesting thing about this is, and we've talked about this a number of times, every time the Americans seem to want to kind of get back to the Indo-Pacific, they keep getting dragged away from the Indo-Pacific. And again, this is a theme that we've talked about before.
Yeah.
And which actually raises an important point, which is, could there be a silver lining to this in the sense that it will really just magnify an existing trend whereby U.S. alliance partners are stepping up in the Indo-Pacific to help ensure security in the Indo-Pacific. So, for example, we had the recent meetings in the U.S. between the U.S. and Japanese and also the Filipinos, too. I mean, you know, the silver lining might be that, you know, the alliance partners realize that they really need to step up and help to contribute. And that's one of the explicit messages the Japanese Prime Minister had in Washington.
Yeah, I guess, you know, you have no choice, right? I mean, in the sense that when the hegemon is so busy in not only cooking in another stove and another oven, but literally in another kitchen altogether, that somehow somebody has to man the fires in these other kitchens. So so I, you know, as you were talking about, you know, American desire, U.S. desire of building in Indo-Pacific, more attention in the Pacific, but being dragged away from it. You know, recently I've just been thinking a little bit about this term. You know, the nomenclature change from Asia-Pacific to Indo-Pacific, right?
Yep.
I kind of, you know, Nick, we have been talking about this, the fact that globalization, we are maybe in an era of already post-globalization, so to speak, that I, in my mind now, that I associate Asia-Pacific as that era of globalization. And Indo-Pacific now, to me, my reaction to the term now, it describes a conflictual situation. You know, despite the fact that I know Shinzo Abe talks, when he started proposing this idea, free, open Indo-Pacific, you know, that's what he was saying. Yeah. But to me,
it's evolved. It's taken a life of its own, right?
Yeah, and then the funny thing is that it was introduced. The term was introduced under a Trump administration that was confrontational. So how can Indo-Pacific term be equal to
free and open?
Free and open and peaceful. And open. Yeah. You know, so I guess the term now really to me signifies a more conflictual international relations and international politics. And the silver lining, maybe it is a silver lining, but maybe because the members of the region, the countries in the region, have no choice.
Yeah, I don't think it's a silver lining as so far that it's the reality that we have to face, right? Because it's no longer so clear-cut. This is not World War II where you have the axis of evil. This is not the Cold War where you have the communists. You know, the groups and the competing interests and influences are now so varied, and I won't even call it multipolar because, you know, Iran wants to ascend on its own, and it's an actor on its own, you know. Yes, it's connected to Russia, but they are not aligned on everything.
So
the Russians are on their own. India has its own interests it's pursuing. China, you know, as the regional hegemon wants to be, is, but they're also on their own. Everyone is.
Yeah, this is, we're back to a realist world.
Yeah,
yes.
We're back to a realist world. We're in nation states have now become important again.
Yes. Right.
You know, initially, you know, the globalization has told us that we're marching towards this multinational, you know, whatever. Even the, you know. Sorry, but the reality is, even within the EU, national interests are still important.
Yeah, you look at why is Orban doing so well in Hungary, and all the European elections that are coming up. You know, everyone is projecting that the far right are going to capture all the seats.
Yeah,
You know, they're going to follow the way of Hungary. They're going to follow the way of Italy, and really challenge. You know, why is Macron suddenly being so active as a French leader trying to promote military intervention in the conflict? Because, you know, Marie Le Pen is breathing down his neck and the polls.
One question I'm curious is why, you know, what's the strategy with regards to Israel? What was the political strategy there when they decided that, okay, we bomb the Iranian consulate in Damascus, knowing full well that is in a way violation of accepted international law, right? So why would the Israeli do that? I mean, what's the thinking of the Netanyahu government to agree to that?
It's BB, right? Like, so Al Jazeera had a little analysis where they interviewed this professor of conflict and humanitarian studies in the Qatar Foundation, Hamad bin Khalifa University. So this professor Sultan Barakat, and he talks about, you know, BB's motivation to go forward with the April 1st attacks were mainly to first and foremost extend the status of the war, because if the war is extended, wartime emergency laws is extended, so he remains in power. He doesn't have to go and face the Supreme Court. Yeah, doesn't have to go and face Supreme Court and answer for his supposed crimes, everything.
An embezzlement.
Yeah. And then, you know, he knows that by firing on an Iranian consulate, Iran will definitely retaliate. And when Iran retaliates, you know, Israel is no longer the big bad guy conducting a humanitarian genocide in Gaza right now. They become the victims being attacked by an Arab power in the Middle East. And we know what happens when Israel gets attacked by an Arab power in the Middle East. Like we saw today, the US and the UK can't wait to jump and say, oh, our dedication to Israel's survival is ironclad.
Nick, do you see this spreading?
I don't actually, because to adopt a metaphor, I mean, I don't think it's a dominoes falling scenario where chaos in one region catalyzes chaos in another region.
Yeah.
Just like, for example, just because the Ukraine situation in Europe is, you know, just going out of control, doesn't mean that Indo-Pacific necessarily will have this domino effect.
Yeah, but will it spread within the Middle East itself?
That's perfectly possible. The thing with the regional spread is I just can't see the causal mechanism necessarily.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing.
I think it's just opportunity because, like I mentioned, like you don't know whether Iran's actions are enough to appease its nationalistic public at home. You know, this idea of save, you know, for honor and saving face, and have I reclaimed my honor after being attacked? If the public see it's not enough, then the pressure's on Iran to react. And then what happens to the Iranian proxies? They see that Iran has launched one salvo. Do they see the opportunity for them to instigate something more? Because we assume that just because they're proxies, that means Iran has total control over them. But history tells us that no matter what proxy you are, they
have their own thinking.
Yeah.
They move on their own.
Just look at the Mujahideen and the CIA. What happened to that? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Would Israel be able to fight on many fronts? Is it in a position?
Well, they have in the past.
That? Yeah, they have in the past. But this is a different situation. You have a very fatigued. It's an unpopular government.
Yep.
Israel within Israel, there are protests against the Netanyahu government for sure. They are less unified than the Six Day War, the Yom Kippur War. You know, all those wars of wherein Israel was able to manage to beat a united Arab front. This time around, world opinion is quite mixed on what's happening in Gaza.
Well, let's go where the money flows, right? The biggest aid donors to the Israelis are the Americans and the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't see them wanting any extended conflict, really. I think they want to minimize it.
Yeah, but the thing is, if conflict does extend, if it boils down to an Iranian-Israel conflict, the U.S. will step up its aid. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Congress will approve to fast-track whatever aid. You know, the F-35s that they've been holding back, they're going to be dropped into Israel's lap right away.
You know, when you were talking about that, Orson, one thing that came to mind is that I said, oh, man, Zelensky must be so upset.
Yeah.
He's so upset. You know, I mean, now that this happens, then the Germans are diverting resources over to Israel. United States has already diverted resources to Israel. This is giving a lot of free play for Putin's Russian army to inflict more.
In fact, so you could even say that he's the big winner, isn't it, Putin?
Yeah. I think in a way, again, you know, very, very obvious at the moment for us in the region is the economic effects of that and the trade effects of that. But we do have to watch for whether this spreads and in other forms, other than, you know, it could be because, you know, I know that the Americans were worried and the Israelis were certainly worried and Western powers supporting Israel are also worried that Iran may be hitting on assets, their assets elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, so it's actually increasing the security concerns of many, you know, Western countries because who knows, it could, you know, these domestic terrorism issues that could happen is something that is not out of the realm of possibilities.
Yeah, right? Because then, you know, when that happens, we also can't ignore the fact that, like we said last week, Islamic terrorism is back again.
Yeah.
Has never gone away. And you just don't know what they will do.
Yeah.
You know, as much as there's that schism between the Sunni Shiites and the, you know, ISIS-K wanted to target Mexico because of its support for pushing arms to Iran. It's also an opportunity for them, right? The more chaotic it is, the more easy it is for them to look its cast its eyes on potential targets.
Yeah.
American assets in the region that they can target as well to make a statement.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really I'm not surprised by the Iranian reaction. I'm just concerned that with the breakdown, so-called breakdown of this order in the world today and the very, very stretch hegemon, that we are going to see more of this.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the comment you made, right? What do you call a situation that's messier than messy?
Yeah. This is really messier than messy already. And I don't even know how to call it. So,
but again, it highlights to us that the era we came out of, right, from 1991 to, say, 2017 is looking more and more
an exception rather than the rule.
It's just a divergence from...
Could never have lasted, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's what Mersheimer would call a kind of the unipolar moment, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, it's much more than a moment, but it's an era that's...
No, I mean, in the grand scheme of human history, it is just a flash in the pan, right? We had 20-odd years of...
20, 30 years of peace, prosperity,
yeah.
And then I think everything goes to normal again.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it comes to a point, that, Nick, you were talking about this Mersheimer's unipolar moment in a way that that moment can only last as long as the hegemon himself feels... compelled to continue providing for public goods, you know, and once
I guess Mersheimer would say it's the liberal international order coming to a close.
Yeah, well, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that the hegemon no longer wants to play the role of that hegemon in a way, as defined, you know, so. We're back to this Olsen idea that the stationary bandit is getting tired and do not know whether we should be charging more taxes and giving more public goods, and it doesn't want to do that anymore.
And so this monopoly of violence is being challenged.
That's right. And certainly, no, you know, there is a weakening of the so-called monopolization of violence, right? So so we're back to that era now. So which is a good, you know, move to this next thing, to next topic that we are interested in talking about. You know, Nick, you sent us this our news article, and in fact, it's an op-ed, a news analysis by a New York Times. The title is "Biden's Trade Moves Raise Tensions Abroad but Draw Cheers in Swing States." And then there's another analysis that got published in Foreign Policy, right?
Yeah.
And the title, written by Keith Johnson, and the title is "Janet Yellen Has a Three-Body Problem with China." The subheading there, the U.S. Treasury Secretary blasted Beijing's industrial overcapacity, but it's a tough message to carry off convincingly. So we have said this in the past, that are we going into an era of great power protectionism.
Yes.
In the name of security. In the name of security. And obviously, we are seeing that right now. America is moving to an industrial policy.
Yep.
It is now actively decoupling.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that in a recent meeting that I have, some economists were telling me that the United States have told suppliers, exporters, that by 2026 or sometime along that time, that any export that they will sell to the U.S. would need to have a certificate that says it doesn't have it doesn't have any input or raw materials from the PRC. You know, zero input. So this is, you know, we are talking about decoupling.
Yeah.
Better way, a more common way to say it is divorce. You know, this is actually a divorce proceeding now. So like, you know, and I guess the question that I want us, I know this is not, we won't be able to answer all of this. We're not even, and we're just wanting to reflect on this.
Yeah.
And we have been chatting amongst ourselves that maybe we should actually, the Institute, Institute for Indo-Pacific Affairs, should actually hold several webinars, and then we can bring in experts to reflect on this issue of what I call, you know, what is the implication of maybe we are actually entering an age of mercantilism in a post-globalization 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we think about this, mercantilism at its height in the 15th, 16th, and 1700s, lots of wars, lots of conflict.
Yes.
You know, imperialism was the norm. So while some say that we are not in a new Cold War, the language, narratives, and rhetoric used are increasingly looking more and more like some kind of a Cold War rather than not. So in my mind, one difference is that global mercantilism is not present during the post-Cold War, but post-globalization Cold War, on the other hand, is increasingly mercantilist, which could turn a Cold War into a hot war.
Yep.
Right? So, and because interdependence that liberals told us that globalization will bring is supposed to stop us from punching each other in the face, but if decoupling succeeds and we are no longer coupled because we are divorced, I guess we just have to ask, you know, the divorce lawyers how nasty divorce proceedings can be.
Yes.
So so the Iran situation, the problem that we're seeing in the Middle East, is this just a sign of the times that we are now in post-globalization mercantilism 2.0?
I think we are, you know. I think for so long we were so reluctant to call great power strategic competition as the new Cold War because we didn't want to make that illusion and the connection to the conflict and the threat of war and everything. But what we failed to realize when we were also caught up between these, the US and China having their strategic rivalry, is that everyone else under that table was also feeling the pinch, and everyone else was acting in its own self-interest, you know, and trying and stirring the pot. And we are at a stage where it reminds me of this article, this journal piece written by Paul Papayanu from the States on a balance of power. So he studied the European nations before World War I and talking about what sort of relationship will make the ideal situation where a balance of power situation can occur. And we are not in that situation anymore because we are in a world which has one clear big power in military sense, ascending big power, then all these minor powers that are of varying capabilities that don't balance each other out. There are no clear sides to it. There's no, like I said just now, you know, there's no two camps anymore. It's all everyone for themselves. And when it becomes everyone for themselves, it becomes very easy for conflicts to start, you know, and conflicts start small. Iran, Israel, Israel, Hamas,
and China, Taiwan.
China, Taiwan. Ukraine, Russia, and it grows big.
Yeah, and this is Nick. We were talking about what this three-body problem mean. So, introduce that term to us. Does three-body term mean?
So, three-body problem is a term from astronomy. Okay, where it refers to the problem of determining the motion of three celestial bodies moving under no influence other than that of their mutual gravitation. And there's no general solution to this problem because the motion of the bodies quickly become chaotic.
Now, the thing is...
So, it's a very unstable...
Very unstable situation.
So, it's all these variables that, yes, they are connected to each other, but they have...
mutual gravitation connection only.
But they are moving so... They start picking up speed and having a life of their own that they get out of control.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's a escalation situation.
It can. It can, right? Yeah.
I think of it like the rock rolling down the hill and gathering moss and then the moss keeps gathering and goes bigger and bigger and we see it right now. We see it right now. What, you know, that's this whole US-China strategic competition, you know, it's evolving because we don't talk the same languages. We don't see the world the same way. Our paradigms are so different. And we've let all these variables and issues, you know, gather up momentum and push us to the point that we come back down again.
You're right. You know, these little things that are all these different bodies that we have through the dyadic interactions of states, even right? So the China-Philippine situation just in the Thomas Shoal and in the South China Sea is now bringing in other, in your analogy, the moss that are coming in. Now you have the Philippine moss, the Australian moss, the Japanese moss, and the American moss rolling into that pebble now. So
yeah, I mean, it just highlights this whole issue of complexity in international politics, and things just aren't as black and white as they were in the last 50, 60 years.
Nick, as a realist, how do you see it necessarily conflictual? And if it's not necessarily conflictual, what's holding the gunpowder dry?
Well, I mean, my sense is that certainly among the great powers, you know, China, US, it is already very conflictual.
Yep.
But in terms of, for example, relations between the US and its alliance partners, you could argue that they've actually improved.
But right? In the great power
time. China, Russia have improved, right?
Yeah, but with the two major players, right? Yeah. So are they going to duke it out somewhere?
Then the next question is, will it always improve? Because right now, we are deepening our relation with New Zealand's deepening its relation with the United States because of necessity and the feeling of threat and everything, and the alliance partners in the region are all doing the same thing. But at the end of the day, if the US is really mercantilist and still refuses to open up market access to the growing economies, there's no point, right? Military alliances will not stand up to economic pressures.
In a situation like we were in the First World War, where all these small states are also using their own national interests to build up their militaries, and they're tying the alliance into whatever, so the bigger countries can actually be brought into a conflict that they didn't want to.
Yeah, the war by arrow.
You know,
World War One
scenario. And now we're
right.
So just think about it.
May not be the case. Yeah.
Yeah. So in a situation we're in Southeast Asia, a lot of countries are arming to the hilt.
Yep.
They're arming to the hilt, and what is the likelihood of literally a brush between two ships? That ended up that the two captains of the ship start shooting each other and then bringing all the other forces that explicitly committed. Like, for example, Biden said that I'm definitely going to help out. U.S. is definitely going to help out the Philippines in the South China Sea. Despite the fact that it's actually unclear that the United States, because it's contested sovereignties there, the United States in the past have actually stayed out of it.
Yep.
You know, yep. But this time around, Biden is saying that he'll be committed. And then it kind of sounds like First World War again, you know?
What about us?
Yeah.
We are in a military alliance with Malaysia and Singapore. And Malaysia, Anwar, is under a lot of pressure the past few days because there was another confrontation just off the coast of Malaysia between Chinese Coast Guards and oil drilling Malaysian ships.
Malaysian ships.
And now they are, you know, these Malaysian citizens are all criticizing Anwar for saying that they have no problem with China and everything, because they feel that they clearly have a problem. You know, China's encroaching on their what could be a big gold mine for Malaysia.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I can just interject here with a little bit of the insights from IR theory. Typically, in a bipolar international system, the hegemon or the pole, because of disparity in power capabilities, has more leverage over the alliance partners than in a multipolar system, right? Yes. So the question now is, are we in a bipolar or are we in a multipolar system? I would have to say we're in a bipolar system. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to replicate the Cold War situation where the alliance partners have very tight control over the alliance network. It might be that we're in this situation now where, for example, Biden is saying things like he's committed and doubling down with the Filipinos and so forth, where he's putting the U.S. national security interests in effect in Marcos' hands, right? Which I don't think is a particularly wise thing to do.
Yeah, and I don't think he wants to do that either, right? Because it is letting the small powers, it's
that's
the
right.
tail wagging the dog, right?
Yeah, this is agency in a way that we don't want it. I mean,
yeah, but you know, which brings to the point that you were raising, the quote unquote silver lining. When middle power agency becomes much more evident now, because the hegemon has attention elsewhere, what are the chances of middle power agency actually making the stew really bad?
I think what happens is that when middle power agency grows beyond a certain size, it introduces the variable of uncertainty into the equation, right?
And too many cooks now.
Yeah, under a bipolar world, you know, you have a clear equation where you know how things will react, how the dominoes will fall, exactly how everything will happen. But because, you know, we've said it before, the US is overly stretched, it cannot commit, and, you know, the alliance partners, the middle powers are all stepping up and even small countries are trying to seize the opportunity or to read the winds of change and they try to react. That just creates more variables.
Yeah. And then, you know, it goes to Sabelis' idea, you know, George Sabelis' idea now, right? Wherein you are actually having multiple players, and if the middle powers now own the problem, let us say, and they are now stepped in big time, right? You cannot tell me that the middle powers will have no veto. You know, I mean, they are the ones on the front line. They will be feeling that, well, you are not doing anything, so we're in. So now once we're in, each of us are actually veto players.
Yep.
And in order for each of these veto players to collaborate and have an effective collective security, collective action, then the challenge is that does Philippines, South Korea, Japan, Australia, do they actually have exactly the same win sets?
Nope.
You know? Or because if they don't have exactly the same win sets, then there are still issues, right?
Yep.
There are still issues there. It's very difficult for them to act together when you have to coordinate with four or five other possible veto players, right? Australia.
But you got to keep in mind, Alex, that the United States still has a lot of levers. It controls, for example, in AUKUS, right, technology. It's actually the Americans working with the Brits who are the ones who are dispensing technology to the Aussies over time. The Americans are the ones who have the resources.
But we are, Nick, but you are assuming that this is linear, right? That the American power is, that the Americans will continue to have this, sure, this technological lead, this levers, as opposed to the fact that right now American attention is elsewhere, right? So will America continue to have those levers, a hegemon? Will they continue to have those levers that can control and constrain?
We don't even know
their alliances.
Yeah,
their,
I mean, you have partners. A good point there. For example, you know, the Taiwanese controlling the chip market, and you know, and Japanese and Europeans, the Dutch, they have certain technologies that the Americans don't have, and the comparative advantage. And you know, it might just be this is a Western bloc issue where they have comparative advantage in certain aspects, certain technologies.
Yeah.
And therefore the weaker part, well, so-called non-poles, now actually have more influence than previously.
Yeah. In fact, you know, in a way, when you think of when the example of Taiwan is very illuminating, in fact. You know, the fact that Taiwan was able to develop this niche in semiconductor manufacturing at the advanced level, it in a way drew in America. It pulled America in to a conflict that
doesn't want to be
that
in.
They may not want to be in. Yeah. And that's one reason why there is now this idea of China plus one, right? And I've also heard this version of what is called Taiwan plus one.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So you can see the recent reports that the Biden administration is increasing subsidies to the TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Corporation, in order for them to set up shop elsewhere.
So what this discussion is showing is that actually you need to look beyond the structural level. So even if you have a bipolar situation between the Chinese and Americans now, there's a lot more other stuff, other variables going on. That complicates things. And you know, bipolar peace during the Cold War may not be replicated in the US-China bipolar situation. There's too many other things, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is, like I said at the start of this segment, that we will not be able to solve this issue. And we're not trying to. We're not trying to solve. Well, what the four of us are doing actually is just thinking out loud, you know, what is happening to the world today? What does it mean going forward for the next 5 years, 10 years, as the dynamics of these dyadic relationship between the United States and China and different dyadic relationships are happening as well? And like Orson, you were saying that these are celestial bodies being pulled in its own gravitational pull, but can be chaotic. And
It is already chaotic, right? And the question that we're asking right now is, what is our view of the world? You know, what is the world looking like to us at the moment? You know, you mentioned it, you know, you said when the US and Japan made the announcement about its, you know, its deal and its relationship and, you know, upholding the values of international rules-based order. Winston Peters in Washington said the same thing. You know, the New Zealand-US relationship is built on mutual respect for these shared principles. But are we envisioning a world that is the same as everyone else? Is the paradigms that we are looking through the same as everyone else? Because it's increasingly feeling like in this new post-globalized world that we step into, that the paradigms are all so multivariate that...
Yeah, and which this brings to my my analogy earlier when I was introducing this segment, right?
Yeah.
This is kind of like going into a divorce, right? So essentially, the world and all of us are all sleeping in the same bed. But somehow, we may have different dreams.
Mm-hmm.
We're dreaming differently. And what we meant by that, and when Orson brings in the topic of international rules-based order, when Kishida announced in the White House, in his speech, that Japan, that the United States is not the only country holding up the rules-based order, that Japan is as well. But does Kishida's international rules-based order mean the same thing as the United States international rules-based order, given post-Trump America?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Post-Trump America. So this is a big question for us, and we would like to revisit this in the future and
continue to unpack it.
Yeah, we will continue to unpack it, and I think we will recruit other experts into either our podcast here, or even our institute, the IIPA, holds a webinar, and when we can invite the speakers to talk about these the reflection on what we call post-globalization period, and what the implications on economics, security, and politics. Well, without further ado, guys, I would like to draw this particular episode to a close and like to thank Nick for logging in just at the right time, and for Neil for slogging through despite not feeling very, very well. Get well very soon. And Orson for being the master tech guy here. And there you go. Thank you very much for listening to us. Please subscribe to our program. We really appreciate you listening to our program. It, you know, to us, we just feel like we wanted to share our thoughts on the situation that's happening in the world today. So thank you again, and have a nice day.